From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's the Week in Review and another week of sexual assault allegations on Beacon Hill and Capitol Hill. We'll look at the flurry of resignations.
It's become clear that I can't both pursue the Ethics Committee process and at the same time remain an effective senator.
Also today, have you noticed all those new anti-smoking ads? They're 11 years in the making, and they come just as most states, including Massachusetts, have given up on their own anti-smoking ad campaigns. Plus, the president of Colby College on the surprising legacy of Samuel Osborne, a janitor at the main school in the late 19th century, who was also formerly enslaved.
He'd speak at commencement, he hosted students during Thanksgiving. He was really a central figure in the life of the college. That says a lot about the impact that he had here during his time.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's Friday, which means, yes, it is time for the Week in Review, beginning with continued allegations and now consequences of sexual abuse and harassment. This week, two Democratic lawmakers stepped down. Here's longtime Michigan Congressman John Conyers speaking on WPZR in Detroit following allegations that he harassed staffers, including by walking out of a bathroom naked and rubbing his hands on their legs.
They're not true, and I think that they are something that I can't explain where they came from.
Yesterday, Senator Al Franken announced his resignation following allegations from at least a half dozen women who say he groped them.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
And in Massachusetts, Stan Rosenberg temporarily stepped aside as state Senate president as his husband is investigated for sexually harassing at least four men. Here's the acting president of the Senate, Harriet Chandler.
Somebody has got to lead the chamber, and this is an acting, it's temporary, and I think that's the best we can do.
Well, we've got a great panel to discuss the week's news with us today. Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and co-host of the Lincoln Review podcast. Ed, welcome to Radio Boston to you.
Thank you for having me here.
It's great to have you. All right, so let me just get your first thoughts from both of you on the resignations that we have seen this week. I mean, beginning with Conyers and Al Franken. Michael, did they take the, well, I guess I should say Conyers is stepping down, but did they take the right actions?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time. I think this is truth catching up to history. I think we've had women for many generations complaining about this kind of behavior in government and politics, in the media and entertainment. And there hasn't been an adequate response. And now the timing is right, and these folks are now being held accountable, and in many cases are having to resign. And I think it's important as an attorney, I would say, it doesn't mean every allegation is 100% completely true, but it means that there's some culpability. There's something they did wrong that they acknowledge, and hopefully there are the right systems, whether it's court or whether it's ethics organizations, commissions, that can look at it and see what the behavior was.
Okay, so let's talk about that a little more. I mean, Ed, what's your take? Because now I'm starting to ask myself the question of accountability and proportionality as well. I mean, is Al Franken resigning before there was a Senate Ethics Committee investigation the right thing to do? He was under pressure from 32 of his fellow Democrats.
Well, I'm really trying to stay very positive despite all this terrible news we're hearing. I'm telling myself that all these bad things have happened and, as Michael says, have been happening, and that what is different now is justice is arriving. So I'm trying to stay positive, saying this is not a happy moment, but it is a good moment. There are millions of women out there saying, thank God this is finally happening. Now, because this movement has been very momentum-based, it seems to be very important to keep the momentum going. I do think there will probably be people who are maybe accused who were innocent, or people will be punished too much. But I think that when justice arrives, I think that we should be welcoming it and understand that it won't be perfect. But I do think that the people that are worried about this going too far would never have brought us to this moment.
Okay, interesting. Just to bring us up to speed, because the news keeps coming on this front, right? We have Arizona Republican Congressman Trent Frank resigning yesterday, saying he's going to step down at the end of January because of allegations that he physically intimidated, coerced, or tried to discuss surrogacy with members of his staff. And also House Ethics Committee in Washington opened a separate probe into Texas Republican Representative Blake Farenthold. So, until last night, I was thinking, are Republicans going to start feeling this accountability and justice moment? And apparently the answer is yes.
Right. It's a long time coming. I think the reality is we didn't see much of a reaction at the top with President Trump. And I think the women in those cases, and again, you can try to determine which one of them have merit or not. But the reality is that there's a critical mass of women who've accused him of the same thing, and he was never held accountable. And we as a nation ignored it. Yeah. And shame on all of us for that. Shame on the electorate that didn't think that was critical to deciding whether he should be president. And then we have Roy Moore in Alabama. Where are we going to be there, and what's the electorate going to do in Alabama? And if they ignore that, again, shame on them as the voters. Mm.
So, Ed and Michael, I'm going to come back to this question now, because it is the thing that I'm starting to think about in the last couple of days, that you both are exactly right. Like, there's this question of justice and accountability, right? I mean, and no one should ever diminish the reality of the victims and their experience. And there is this momentum, right, that's hopefully causing some sweeping change. I acknowledge all of that. But I do also wonder, are we at the risk of a backlash if there isn't some kind of proportionality with some of these cases? I'm thinking, going back to Al Franken, yes, more than half a dozen women. But at first he wanted to actually have an investigation, but he was under so much pressure that never happened.
Yeah. It's funny. I always make the comparison to these cases to racism. I believe most people who think that there's not a lot of racism don't know what racism is. Right. And there's a lot of people who think they're not racist who are. Who perpetuate racism and just don't understand it. And I think the same thing happens with this sexual abuse, misconduct, that the more people understand it, the more they'll realize it's rampant, it's pervasive. And as a society, we got to decide, okay, now that we are more conscious, how will we do this due process thing to make sure that people that the allegations are investigated, that they're confirmed, and that then there's the punishment that follows that. Right now, I think, as we talked about, the pendulum has swung the other way, where now people are just being called upon to resign without the evidence, without the conversation. But we got to get to some place where there's an investigation, there's some proof, and people have to take the appropriate action.
Ed?
Yeah, I mean, Ruth Marcus said in the Washington Post yesterday that, we have Bob Menendez, who is in the U.S. Senate, who certainly looks like he was engaged in bribery. And that they said, oh, well, there's due process. And the case went to a jury. It was a hung jury. And the Senate's going to keep investigating him. But everyone said, no, it's important. He's innocent until proven guilty. And he's still there. And there isn't a lot of outcry that he leave because due process is important. Normally, I would say that, wait a second, maybe we should get some more due process around these allegations. But I think the due process people should just hustle and get going and do this. I think that it seems to me that momentum is so important this happening, women building on the strengths of other women coming out. I really would not want to try to slow that down in the name of a process that might not arrive. Michael is absolutely correct.
Right.
The fact that people who are agitating for change are always told you're doing it too fast or you're doing it wrong or people will be blamed too much. Women have been told who are harassed, oh, you shouldn't accuse that man. He'd be overly punished. And, everyone's being told to sort of pull back. I think it's crazy to say now, like, we're worried about this getting out of control when there's so much justice to be done. So I do think that needs some more due process. But if you are a due process guy, I want you to stay up all night and figure this out.
Because
I think the answer is for them to hustle, not for everyone else to slow down.
So, Ed, I'm going to stick with you here for a second, because your point is well made and well taken. But I'm also continuously perplexed by, on the one hand, with Franks and Farenthold, we've got some action going on Republican House regarding Republican House members. But
there will be more.
The RNC still stands by Roy Moore. And if we're talking proportionality, he's over there in the allegedly over there in the Harvey Weinstein end of things. But the party is rallying around him to put him in the Senate.
Well, I think that the fact that the party didn't even acknowledge they were doing this means that if they're having a rally, it's under cover of darkness here. I mean, we know about it, but it isn't like they told anybody they were doing this. It is absolutely shameful. But I think it's just – it's polarization. I think that there are – you know, there's more than one pathology at work in American politics right now. So I think that polarization has led us to this moment of tribal loyalty where we are unable to detect other kinds of injustice. So I think that, people haven't fully digested what polarization has done to American politics. I would like to think that this – the RNC supporting Roy Moore is going to convince us that polarization has a much higher cost than we think it does.
So not to make light of the serious point you made, but my director and I, we like to make crazy T-shirts. And I have a new one. There is more than one pathology at work in American politics right now. Ed Lyons. I think it's smart analysis there.
And just because a sin is a sin is a sin. But what Roy Moore is accused of is at the worst end of the sins, right?
Oh, be careful. There's still a few days left in the election. Something worse may come out.
And I think that's not talked about enough. I think the fact that the RNC, the president, are supporting him despite what he's alleged is doing, and that there's quite a bit of critical mass of complaints that he did, it really shocks me that we are there as we're so polarized and tribal as a country.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what's happening here locally in Massachusetts on this issue, because as we mentioned at the top of the segment, Stan Rosenberg is temporarily, for now at least, stepping aside as state Senate president as his spouse is being investigated for allegedly harassing at least four men. Senate Democrats in the State House caucused for about 8 hours this week, and they chose a new temporary president, Senator Harriet Chandler. Here's part of what she said.
We hear the victims of these allegations. We admire their courage in coming forward. No one who serves, works, or does business in the Massachusetts State House should feel unsafe, coerced, or unsupported.
And here's Governor Charlie Baker on Tuesday saying that there does need to be a thorough investigation.
And I really believe that it's hugely important for this investigation to be completely independent of the Senate, so that these folks believe they can come forward and speak to these issues without worrying about repercussions.
Ed, your thoughts on how this is being handled on Beacon Hill?
Well, I'm glad the issue's been raised. I feel bad for President Rosenberg. I don't think he's going to return. I think this investigation will show that he either enabled this or he was helpless. Neither of those outcomes will make people want to return him to his leadership post. I'm hoping that this commission expands its charter and includes more cases of harassment. I know people on Beacon Hill. They claim there have been problems for a long time, even if they are not being named. So I hope that, you know, Senator Chandler is sincere, and I hope that message gets out there. They don't have jurisdiction over Hefner at all. So I hope that what happens is they create sort of a clearinghouse for all kinds of other complaints and people come forward. That would be, to me, the best outcome of this.
So, again, a tip of the hat to Yvonne Abraham and her reporting in The Globe that brought these stories to us. And I'm a total broken record on one point here, and that is every single person who spoke to her said that they had nowhere to go. There was no one they could talk to, no one they felt that they could report to. Not just in this case with Rosenberg's spouse, but the other harassment cases she's been reporting on. And that, to me, Michael, seems to be the thing that can be most immediately fixed.
Right. Right. And I think there's some calls within the legislature. I know we've heard the Speaker and the Senate President talk about changing the culture and putting some processes in place to make sure that those things can be reported. I also want to echo that I've known the Senate President, and I'm actually discouraged. I'm disappointed by how this is playing out. I think he's a genuinely good man who took the presidency and opened up the process. He invited a lot of us in to talk about all the issues we care about and said, I really want to make sure that this is a big tent to include as many issues as possible. I don't share the belief that he will end up having had something to do with this. I hope not.
And at least a couple of the cases, though, he's allegedly to have been just several feet away.
Yeah, I think this is probably one of those cases that we've all had, if you've ever been in a position of influence, that the spouse, the friend, somebody in your circle is power peddling and making it sound like they can get something done because they have a relationship with you. I would imagine that's rampant, no matter whether you're in entertainment or politics, and people do it. But I hope, based on what I know of him, and the integrity that I've seen out of his office, that that this ends up the right way.
But Michael, let me ask you. I mean, this is a tough one because Brian Hefner, Rosenberg's spouse, got in trouble before. I mean, for sending out tweets of maligning Therese Murray and following that. That's what Senator Rosenberg said he was going to make a firewall between his spouse and activities on Beacon Hill. So had those previous incidents and promises not been part of this picture, I get what you're saying.
Right.
But there's a track record here, which is why I think a lot of people are worried about how much can they trust Senator Rosenberg.
Yeah, I just don't know. And I have family members and relationships over the years, and I don't know how much you can control anyone else in your family or someone you love doing something that's reckless. I think you can do your best to do that. And I'm hoping as they do the investigation, they will see that he put those firewalls in place. And in the end, if they find out that he did participate in this, then I believe he should not return as Senate president. But I'm hoping that that's not the case.
We'll see what the investigation turns out when it does turn it out. Just got a couple minutes, but there's another big story that I do want to touch on that happened this week in Massachusetts. And that has to do with State Auditor Suzanne Bump, because yesterday she released a very troubling report on the Department of Children and Families. She found at least 260 cases between 2014 and 2015 where a child under DCF supervision had suffered serious injury, but DCF wasn't aware of those injuries. Bump told us that she believes it's a sign of some serious failings at DCF.
We used the information at our disposal, the same information that DCF has at its disposal, but does not use, still does not use.
I mean, more than implying there that there's no reason she believes why DCF should not have known about these cases. Ed Lyons, your thought here. I mean, here is a supremely troubled agency that starting in September 2015, Governor Baker said he was putting it on the road to reform.
So there have been, it is deeply troubled, and it reminds of the MBETA where it has different kinds of problems. Some of them are cultural, some of them are organizational, some of them are oversight, some of them is the complexity of the job that they have. So I think that there was two rounds of reforms. One was in September 2015. Another one was several months later.
That's right.
That seemed more serious. They had the cooperation of the union representative overseeing that part of the government. So I'm hoping that what was put in place, at least after the second round, would answer some of these concerns. I'd like to add that some of the problems here are related to technology, that I think that it's overlooked that when you see these failures in government, that some of them are because systems aren't being used, they're not connected. When Suzanne Bump says that dead people are getting checks they're not entitled to, it's because the system that knows people have died isn't talking to the ones cutting checks for social programs. I think in this case, you know, it's that information was over here in medical records that MassHealth had and not in the hands of people who were on the front lines. So I do think that this is another reason to really say, you know, do these agencies with, you know, tracking 50,000 children is not a person problem, it's a computer science problem. And you have to give people the interface to manage all those cases. You can't manage that many kids one-on-one, right, word of mouth, what's in the office, with sheets of carbon paper. It has to be a very sophisticated. Don't laugh. My daughter was in early intervention in Boston several years ago, and the caseworker came to our house. It was for cognitive delays that are now gone. You know, had sheets of carbon paper to report on what was happening. And I said, my goodness, is this how you're dealing with children?
Wow.
Now,
okay.
I just think that, so it's like there are plenty of problems in government. I want to say that some of them are related to technology.
Therefore should be fixable.
Well, Governor Baker did this. So now I heard they were going to get iPads and they were going to have, you know, submit buttons about different kinds of things. So there is a component of this that isn't just vague. It's saying, no, that this is an information sharing problem. And I support Governor Baker's efforts to modernize the technology in these agencies.
Well, I will give the last word here today to Michael Curry on this.
Yeah, I mean, part of this is what we see in government sometimes anyway, which is just systems not communicating. We see this with funding issues, that you give these departments, these agencies, these secretariats, these huge responsibilities, but they don't have the funding to actually do the work. I think credit to Governor Baker. Much of what Auditor Bump found was prior to the changes that we're talking about.
Yeah, a year and a half prior, exactly.
So, you know, you get in and you figure out what a critical incident is, and if a critical incident does not include rape and sexual misconduct or sexual abuse, you have to include that. So some things that have to change immediately, and it is inherently fraught with failure, and we got to figure out how to get to that and eliminate it. And I'm confident that this administration is taking that seriously, and I'm hoping it'll change as well.
Time flies when the talk is good and smart. So Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP board, thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and co-host of the Lincoln Review podcast. It was great to have you, Ed. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have you seen one of these ads on TV recently?
Smoking is highly addictive. Nicotine is the addictive drug in tobacco. Cigarette companies intentionally design cigarettes with enough nicotine to create and sustain addiction. It's not easy to quit.
Well, that was a clip from new advertisements warning of the dangers of cigarettes and secondhand smoke, and they were paid for by tobacco companies. Now, these ads go back to a case that first began in 1999, and here to talk about why suddenly they've popped up all across media is John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior analyst. Hello, John.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so it's 2017, not 1999. Why are we suddenly seeing all these anti-smoking ads?
Right. So in 1999, the Clinton Justice Department sued the major tobacco companies for racketeering in terms of conspiring to deceive the public about the health effects of cigarettes. Goes through the courts in 2006. A federal district court judge says, yes, that's right. You did conspire to deceive the public. But the racketeering charges didn't allow for financial penalty. The Justice Department was looking for $280 billion in ill-gotten gains from the industry. But you couldn't get it with these civil racketeering charges.
Right.
So the judge said, look, go back to where you ran the deceptive ads and run corrective statements, basically telling the public that you deceived them and these are the real facts.
Okay. But it took, what, 11 years?
So there was 11 years of wrangling. Here's a sample of what the judge wanted the tobacco industry to say. He wanted them to say, we told Congress under oath that we believe nicotine is not addictive. We told you smoking is not an addiction and all it takes to quit is willpower. Here's the truth. Smoking is very addictive and it's not easy to quit. We manipulated cigarettes to make them more addictive. The tobacco industry said these are forced public confessions that are designed to shame and humiliate us. And for the next 11 years, they did horse trading to basically water down the message.
Okay, so here we are in 2017, and all of a sudden in major newspapers, there's these full-page ads and on television. We played that clip earlier. But especially the TV ads, they're just, what, black text on a white screen and this like bizarre computerized
right.
voice? I mean, they're supposed to be corrective statements in response to deceptive advertising from years past. I mean, first of all, as a communications professor, are these effective ads?
These are terrible ads. This is as close to being invisible for 30 seconds as you can get. But the tobacco industry, they're geniuses at doing this kind of advertising that doesn't achieve the effect it seems to want to achieve. So back a while ago, they had to run an ad campaign aimed at young people to tell them, don't start smoking. And you know what the message was? Hey, kids, smoking's for adults.
Oh my God.
You know, okay, so you know, I'd pay for that if I'm the tobacco industry, right? So they're very good at that. But the truth is that these may be the only anti-smoking messages that many people in the public see in mainstream media for the entire year that they're supposed to run.
Okay, so this is the real crux of the story, I think, right? Because you know, the tobacco companies are running these ads because they have to, but states for a long time were running their own anti-smoking campaigns. What happened to those? Why aren't we seeing them anymore?
Absolutely. Massachusetts was a leader. I mean, they had the 1992 ballot initiative that kicked off a whole series of millions and millions of dollars of advertising through the 90s up to 2000. They were spending somewhere between $48 and $55 million a year on anti-smoking programs in 2000. In 2003, it drops off the map, basically. They go down to $6 million because it was the post-9/11 recession and the state needed the money. Since then, what we've seen is more and more money coming in from tobacco taxes and less going to anti-smoking campaigns.
Okay, so hang on here. More and more coming in because of tobacco sales.
Right.
And the tax that Massachusetts levies on those cigarettes.
And payments from the tobacco industry to the states from the 1998 Master Settlement Agreement, which was $206 billion over 25 years.
Okay. But less money being spent by the state for anti-smoking campaigns. I'm hearing the phrase conflict of interest coming up here.
Well, first, just so you get an idea of the scale of this. Okay, in 2015, the state took in $880 million in tobacco revenues between taxes and the payments, and they spent $3.9 million on anti-smoking campaigns. So they are addicted to tobacco money. And one of the questions is, don't they have a conflict of interest here? Do they have a real sincere interest in getting more people to quit than have already quit, because if that revenue stream dries up, they're going to have to go find that money somewhere else. So this is an inherent conflict of interest for states across the country. And really, the CDC recommends that Massachusetts spend roughly $60 million a year on anti-smoking campaigns.
That's what they recommend.
That's what they recommend.
But we're spending, what, four this year?
We're spending four. So you know, that's 6% of what the CDC recommends. You know, across the country, states are spending a combined 14% of what the CDC recommends. So this is something that was a major factor for a while in terms of public health. And now it is not a major factor. And smoking rates or tobacco use rates, if you roll in e-cigarettes, are going up among young people. And one thing about this campaign from the tobacco industry, it may be ineffective, but it also isn't targeting the people who really need to be targeted,
right,
who are young people. But that's social media, and you know, that media world has passed the court by.
It's only television and the newspapers that these ads are showing up in.
Right. That was the ruling.
Yeah. Well, John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior analyst, thank you so much for drawing our attention back to, you know, interesting complexities around state spending when it comes to anti-tobacco advertising. It's always great to have you, John.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You're about to hear the story of a man named Samuel Osborne. He was born around 1833 in Virginia. He worked at Colby College in Maine, starting in 1867. He worked there for 37 years. Samuel Osborne died in 1904, just 1 year after he retired. The then president of Colby College was a pallbearer at Osborne's funeral. And now, the president's house at Colby has been renamed in Samuel Osborne's honor, which would seem befitting for, say, a longtime professor or a college administrator. But Samuel Osborne was a janitor. He was also born into slavery. Here to tell us more about Osborne's remarkable life is the current president of Colby College, David Green, and he joins us from Waterville, Maine. President Green, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on your show.
This is such an incredible and wonderful story. First of all, how did you learn about who Samuel Osborne is?
It really is a remarkable story. I'll have to say it's one that captured my heart and my imagination. I learned about it because when I first came to Colby, of course, I was devouring every piece of history I could when I came here to understand the history, the people who had been here, what had happened over time. And I came across this particular piece of history when I was working on a talk that I was going to be giving on Martin Luther King Day that year. And I came across a work that a faculty member of ours, Mark Tappan, and his students had done when they were looking at the history of social activism at Colby over time. And they had unearthed a number of interesting pieces about Sam Osborne's life. And that brought me to the archives on our campus to learn more.
Well, tell me the story briefly, if you could, about how is it that Samuel Osborne, born into slavery in Virginia, ended up working at Colby in Maine?
It's really an extraordinary story. Of course, Sam Osborne was born into slavery. His father was brought to this country forcibly on a slave ship. And he met his wife, Maria, when they were children on the same plantation, in fact. Just as the Civil War was closing in 1865, Samuel Osborne met a man from Maine, a colonel in the Union Army, who was a graduate of Colby College, and Samuel actually worked for him for a short time. And that colonel brought Samuel north to Maine and brought him to Waterville, Maine. And the president of Colby College at that time helped Samuel get a job at the railroad station nearby. And ultimately, the people of Waterville, including the folks at Colby, helped bring his entire family here.
Wow.
And Samuel ultimately, as you mentioned, became the janitor here for 37 years, following his father, in fact. His father was first hired as a janitor here, and then Samuel took over 2 years later and was here for 37 years.
So, you know, while this is a story that warms the heart, it also contains the reality of the fact that even though they had been freed from slavery, the Osbornes have. I mean, we've discovered that while Samuel Osborne was a beloved janitor at Colby, he still there's literature that says he still had to tirelessly endure the pranks and assaults on his intelligence from the students.
Yeah, there's irony in that as well, because by all accounts, he was extraordinarily intelligent. He had a memory that everybody commented on as being absolutely first rate. He was insightful. He never forgot the name of an alumnus or a student. So to imagine that he may have faced some derision as well, not a surprise given the time and given what a novelty he must have been and given the nature of race relations in the country at that time. But surely any of these stories, given that moment in history, they're complex.
Right. I mean, so the racism just doesn't disappear. It hasn't yet disappeared from America. That's
right. And, yeah. It's hard for me to imagine, as it must be for you, what it must have been like in the 1860s for anybody coming out of slavery and then to come to Maine,
right,
where he was surely a novelty.
Well, but he made an impact on Colby, though, because I'm seeing here that when Samuel Osborne was in his deathbed, that the president then and President Mrs. White went to his bedside in the morning and remained until he passed away? Is that right?
That's my understanding as well. And in fact, on the commencement just prior to his passing, many alums came back because they had heard that he had been ill. And the students marched from their graduation to his home, each one shaking his hand and saying farewell to him at that time. So he clearly played a very special role in the lives of the students and the entire community here. And his story, every time I dig a little bit deeper, there's just these incredibly rich nuggets that show up.
Like the fact that the college bell rang 71 times representing his age when he passed away.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah.
I think that it's really amazing to think about the impact that he had on the lives of people here. And for me, that's one of the reasons why acknowledging that and celebrating it and making sure that we always remember that part of our history is so important.
Mm-hmm. So the story gets even better, though. I mean, we've acknowledged some dark parts, but I want to focus on the light as well, because I understand that Samuel Osborne's daughter, Marion, became a student at Colby.
He had seven children. He and his wife, Maria, had seven children. And Maria, by the way, was known as Mother Osborne on campus. They had seven children, two of whom came to Colby. They had a son who came in the 1890s, and then a daughter, Marion, who came in 1896 and graduated in 1900. She was the first African-American woman to graduate from Colby. And she went on to a great career as a teacher in Brooklyn, New York, and ultimately moved back to Waterville later in life.
Wow. And do we know where the Osborne family is now?
We have not been able to find his descendants. We know where the family is buried here in those who were at the college in Waterville, but we have not been able to find descendants. But we have been able to find, interestingly, a number of people who have come forward with stories about the Osbornes through their own ancestors.
Oh, interesting. Hopefully the word can get out and the research can continue, because it would be amazing to find some of his descendants, given the impact that he's had on Colby College. President Green, there's one more question I want to ask you, because I'm thinking about Colby today, right? You've got some 2,000 students there. Is that right?
That's correct.
And about 28, less than, just under 30% students of color?
Right.
Yeah, so I just wonder, you know, how is it that you can further use Samuel Osborne's legacy to continue to create or even better create a welcoming environment for students of color at Colby College?
Well, I think it's so important for us to recognize those who came before us and who blazed paths in whatever way that might have been. And certainly the Osborne family did that for many. When I first told this story to a group of alums and others, a gentleman who's African-American who graduated from Colby about 40 years ago came up to me and said, "I wish I had known that story when I was at Colby. I would have known at that time that I had a reason for being there and that others had gone through a lot to make sure that I could be here."
Yeah.
And I think for all of us to remember that is just essential.
Well, now the president's house is named in Samuel Osborne's honor. So is there a plaque that tells a little bit of his story or something
that? We're working on that right now. And I want to make sure that everybody understands how important that family was, how hard they worked for us. And one of the things that we really celebrate at Colby is hard work, and that's true for every staff member here, whether they're working on the grounds or they're cleaning buildings or they're working in offices. And so I want to make sure we recognize that part of the story as well.
Yeah.
So we'll be doing that through a plaque and other ways telling the story going forward.
Well, David Green is the 20th president of Colby College in Waterville, Maine. He renamed the president's house in honor of Samuel Osborne, a janitor who worked at Colby in the late 19th century, a man who was also formerly enslaved. It's a truly remarkable story. And President Green, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Meghna, for having me on your show.
I'm hoping that along with listening to this show every day, you also listen to Modern Love, the podcast. It's from the great folks here at WBUR and our friends at the New York Times, and I happen to host that show as well. So today we want to share an excerpt from a recent episode of the podcast with you, and it begins in a hospital pediatrics wing, usually a place of pain and resilience, fear and healing. Normally, the symptoms treated there are physical. But for Thomas Hooven, the hospital became a place for a different kind of recovery. Jake Gyllenhaal reads this essay for us. He stars in the movie Stronger about Boston Marathon bombing survivor Jeff Bauman. Gyllenhaal reads Hooven's Modern Love essay, Nursing a Wound in an Appropriate Setting.
I started my pediatrics residency on the cardiology unit, which was appropriate. My heart had a giant hole in it. Just after I graduated from medical school, as I was moving into my fiancée's New York apartment, she ended our relationship. We went out to dinner that night, and after we came home, she told me we were through. She and I had been together 12 years, engaged for 2. We had a wedding planned for 3 weeks later. I can't believe you're doing this, I said from the edge of her bed. I know we'll always be best friends, she said. I left just after sunrise, suitcase in hand, feeling as if I had just fallen from a moving train. It seemed unimaginable that I was meant to report for duty at the hospital in less than a month. My new employers were expecting a freshly minted physician, full of knowledge and an eagerness to heal. As it was, I could barely remember my name. I took a cab to the airport, booked a flight to my father's house in Minnesota, and stayed there until it was time to limp back to New York to start my residency. I spent the hour that was supposed to have been our wedding ceremony sitting in the crook of a tree, staring at the suburban horizon. The evening was silent. The weather was perfect. After returning from Minnesota, I moved to a marginal block in a neighborhood of highway access ramps and overpasses. Plastic bags blew along the empty streets. Brief walks to and from the hospital and solitary meals with dust motes swirling in my sparse living room were all that interrupted the otherwise constant blur of rounding on patients in the dim morning hours, writing hundreds of medical orders, and updating parents, who ranged from frantic to silently resigned. There are rules about the number of hours a training physician can work in a hospital, but the limit remains high. 80 hours a week. When done back-to-back and filled with children suffering from complex illnesses, weeks like that tend to metastasize, leaving room for nothing else. When I started my work as a doctor, it took every bit of concentration to put aside my private sadness and focus on my patients. I was lost, and it's a wonder I didn't hurt anyone. In moments of downtime, and especially in the depths of night when the unit was quiet, memories of my ex and my longing for her would overtake me. Like a persistent virus, loneliness lived inside me. My ex and I had gone to the same high school. As two children of divorce who had been caught between battling parents, we were drawn to each other like compatriots. We held on to our young romance through 4 years at separate colleges and journeyed across the country to attend graduate school together. We seemed on the cusp of the grown-up lives we had imagined. Actually, we were about to disintegrate. As a couple, we did not fight. Our relationship was conceived from a need for security and stayed small, quiet, and safe. We came together in the disorienting haze of parental conflict, and from the start, we shared a tacit assumption that fighting meant losing love. At the end, surrounded by cardboard boxes we had spent the day hauling into her living room, I asked over and over why she was leaving me. She couldn't articulate a single reason. "I don't know," she said. After more than a decade together, that non-answer amazed me. It seemed the most brutal response possible. But now, more than 5 years later, her response seems less surprising and more diagnostic of why we failed. Our relationship had never developed the vocabulary necessary to express the many colors and intricacies of adult emotion. We had no language for negativity. She must have sensed that and realized we were headed for serious trouble. Compared with many of my patients that year, whose illnesses, complications, and treatment regimens would fill a textbook, my burden of heartache was light. Still, my patients and I inhabited a space in the city together at a time when we were suffering. The hospital is a place for that. Simultaneous suffering. I remember a 15-year-old boy with severe renal failure, tubes through his flanks draining urine directly from his ravaged kidneys. His mother rarely visited him over the many months that he spent admitted. Every night, he would mount dramatic protests about the frequent injections his disease required. One time, his howling screams summoned me to the hallway. It was after midnight. Crouched and sobbing against the wall, head buried in his palms, he looked barely older than 7. I sat on the floor next to him and put my hand on his shoulder. We stayed there for about 15 minutes. Me in my scrubs, him in his thin yellow gown with clowns on it. Both isolated amid the nurses, medications, and monitors. After that, he returned to his room, took the shots, and went to bed. I went back to the tiny sleeping quarters for overnight staff and traipsed into the past, scrolling through old emails from my vanished fiancé and waiting for dawn. Healing comes slowly, but it comes. A budding pediatrician must observe lives cut inexplicably short. The 14-year-old girl with cardiomyopathy who had a heart attack before my eyes and died staring at the ceiling. But I've also been privileged to witness how most gravely ill children overcome or bypass their challenges. They mature. They become wryer. They pick up idiosyncrasies. They smile despite themselves. My patients and I also healed together. For me, healing started through a desire to be a better doctor, the drive to improve my skills as a physician, to recognize diagnoses, know disease mechanisms, and determine the correct treatments, buoyed me, and eventually pulled me out of my sorrow. The long days that were at first such a Sisyphean cycle became a new refuge. For a time, the study and practice of medicine was my only and perfect partner. Sometime during my second year of residency, I emerged from the elevator to see the boy with renal failure cruising down the hallway, using the wheeled base of his IV pole as a skateboard. He had a paper airplane in his hand and tossed it as he approached, laughing as it looped past my head. He was getting better, and so was I. My ex and I are not in touch. Our relationship, so long in the making and so quick to end, was like an ornamental piece of crystal. Aesthetically pleasing, but lacking resilience, and once shattered, irrecoverable. Looking back at the various romantic and not so romantic dating experiences I had afterwards, it's hard to separate my growth as an emotionally conversant partner from my development as a capable physician. Both happened simultaneously and gradually, through stretches of triumph and sorrow. There were no eureka moments, and neither ever really ended. The turmoil I experienced as an intern left me with a deeper understanding of how pain works, how it feels, how it ebbs, and how it leaves you less naive. I also learned to open up to important facets of life that my previous relationship had locked out. Unhappiness, uncertainty, regret. Comfort around feelings like these is crucial in both medicine and intimate relationships. It's the basis of empathy. I didn't understand that before my ex left me, and I learned it the hard way. By the time I met my wife, I was a changed man and a real doctor, and our love developed differently from any I had ever experienced before. Less like a crystal vase, more like a basketball. Our relationship is made for bouncing, for good and sometimes rough play that modern professional lives generate. We do have fights, oh yes we do, but they do not threaten our foundation. They deepen it. I would not return to those difficult and lonely days any more than I imagine my young patients, now grown, would return to the wards where I labored to keep them alive and well. But I would not choose to have avoided that experience either. I ran into the kid with renal failure on the street a while back. He was with a bunch of his pals. It had been years since he left the hospital, and frankly, I wouldn't have recognized him. He had filled out. His chronically ill little boy's face had developed into a sly, winking young man's. His skin had darkened from the sun. He was dressed in a denim jacket with a Bob Marley shirt underneath. Doc, he called out. Hey, Doc. We stood there talking for a few minutes. Enough for me to learn he was finishing high school and doing well. Somewhere nearby, an ambulance siren wailed. I watched him walk away to rejoin his friends and then turned to enter the children's hospital.
Jake Gyllenhaal, reading Thomas Hooven's modern love essay, Nursing a Wound in an Appropriate Setting. Gyllenhaal stars in the movie Stronger about Boston Marathon bombing survivor Jeff Bauman. I hope you enjoyed this sample of Modern Love, the podcast. If you did, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Have a safe and wonderful weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.